What's up, heroes? Welcome to the Producer Life Podcast, episode number 50. I'm your host, the House Ninja, and this week we've got Julian Gray. Julian is a techno, electro, and progressive house artist who has released on Mousetrap, Anjuna Beats, Enhanced, Gravitas, and more. He's performed at major festivals including EDC Orlando, Imagine, and Okeechobee. He has almost 100,000 monthly listeners on Spotify and another 37,000 subscribers to his YouTube channel, where he offers Ableton tutorials and reviews. In part one of the interview, Julian talks about his background, where his signature sound comes from, and lays out the sequence of events that got him signed on Mousetrap.
Skrillex and Zed started there as well, and Madion and all those artists. And I was so inspired by the history of the label. I was like, okay, this is a goal of mine. I want to be on this label one day.
But first, cue the intro music. Welcome, everybody. It is Saturday, December 5th, as I'm recording this, which happens to be International Ninja Day, and I'm absolutely stoked to have Julian Gray on the podcast as our 50th episode guest. So welcome, Julian.
Thanks for having me, man. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you again for your time. I am really excited about this. We've got a lot to talk about, from production to your transition into an artist on Mousetrap to your killer YouTube channel.
Thank you.
Maybe the best place to start would be kind of the beginning, where you kind of got your background. And I understand you've been producing since you were about 10 or 11.
Yeah, so I'm kind of grew up in music. I tell this story a lot. My father is a, basically a do-it-at-home kind of like studio musician, where we used to have like a basement home studio. Nothing too special, but like he was always in music around as a kid. We had pretty decent hi-fi gear and stuff. And, I grew up around music. My mother was like into, industrial music, new wave, Depeche Mode type stuff when I was younger. So like there was always a sense of electronic music in the household. My dad was into recording. He's very musically eclectic like me. And, through those two, parent figures that are very invested in the culture, I think it kind of manifested in music and art. I'm also really into like technology and very like, into electronics and taking things apart, putting them back together. And computers was a huge interest for me growing up. And that marriage of the arts and music that my parents kind of, put upon me when I was younger, and then also like that interest in tech and computer science when I, was a young child, basically kind of manifested together into what is electronic music. And I fell upon a demo software that my father brought home from work one day. He used to be a guitar teacher at like a music store. So I think he brought home like some sort of like digital audio interface, and it came with some demo program of something. It was like a very rudimentary DAW. I think it's called like Energy or something by Behringer, back in the day before Behringer was like cool. He brought it home, and I basically wrote an album when I was like 11 with like the loops and the built-in sounds of this like demo DAW. I couldn't save project files. I would just export them. And, I probably have it somewhere. I don't know where, but I think there's a video on my channel of me reacting to like a mixtape version I made of it. And that's kind of where I got my start. And then from there, graduated to like GarageBand and then FL Studio. And then I was learning to DJ at the time. So then I picked up Ableton, and Ableton's kind of a marriage of DJ and production. And I've fallen in love with that. And over the years, now I'm basically a full-time Ableton teacher on YouTube and a full-time musician. And I use Ableton every day.
With Ableton, and you've kind of got this long-time relationship with that software and that platform. In some of your more recent live streams, it looks like you've kind of swapped to CDJs. Are you still performing with Ableton, or are you mostly using it for production at this point?
Yeah, so that's like a good question, and it's kind of a point of discussion with a lot of people who perform live. There's something to be said about CDJs in that they're very convenient. You can walk into any venue and they have the setup all ready to go. You could just bring in a flash drive basically. And I've done full tours where, you know, just carry around a single flash drive on my keys, and that's all the gear I have to tour with. And I love Ableton Live production stuff, like full scale, like DJ sets in live. A few years ago, I was actually working on a multimedia set where I would, you know, play music in live, and then it would also trigger visuals and lights and all that sort of stuff. And that's like the capability of live. It's a very powerful tool for show building. But with that, like, capability comes like this need of more hardware and more setup time. So I do a little bit of both. For bigger projects that are, you know, if I'm touring an album, like I was actually going to tour this last EP this year before, you know, the virus that shall not be named, you know, I was going to tour with it, and I was building a full on live set, in Ableton, and we were going to do visuals and audio synced with it. And it's easier to do that in live. And when you have a more like straightforward show, Ableton is really powerful for that sort of stuff. But, you know, for something like a occasional DJ set, or if I'm just doing a tour of DJ shows, or just even like a support show, like I did a few dates with Deadmau5, a few dates with Io before his passing, rest in peace to Garrett.
Yeah.
We would use CDJs just because it's easy. You walk into the club and, you know, that's that. I've done a little bit of both over the years.
Okay. Backing up to, you know, your formative years as you were getting into DJing and later on into production, when do you feel like your sort of signature Progresso sound really evolved? At what point did that sort of become definitive for you?
Yeah, I kind of have like this idea of you kind of stumble upon this signature sound. Like a lot of people aspire to create a signature sound, if you will, that all of your music kind of has this fingerprint that everything you do sounds like. And I think that this is kind of something you stumble upon. You don't really ever manifest it literally. Like you don't wake up one day and invent something and then that's your sound. I think that my take on this as a music teacher is that your signature is kind of a culmination of some of your biggest influences and the small things you get from them. So like if I, you know, some of my bigger influences are like Coldplay, Deadmau5, Fleetwood Mac, you know, like they're very different artists, but I take small things like the counter melodies of Fleetwood Mac and internalize that, or like the, you know, writing style of Deadmau5, or like the, you know, the space and the songwriting of Coldplay. And you culminate all those things together and you end up taking little bits and pieces from your biggest influences. And as you start to do that, you fall upon your signature sound. So I think, I don't know the exact date of which, like, you know, I came across this quote unquote Progresso sound. Some fans started calling it that, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. But I think that if you go back as far, even as like those early demos I was referring to earlier on that one demo DAW, you can kind of identify my music just based on, you know, my writing styles and the influences that, you know, I got from other musicians. And that's kind of my philosophy on signature sounds. I don't think I like invented one. I think I've just, you know, culminated all of my interests into what I do now.
Sure. I know a lot of my listeners will already be familiar with you, but some of them may not. Can you kind of characterize what Progresso means to you?
It's kind of like a culmination of, like, if you take Deadmau5, mix it with, you know, some counter melodies from 80s, you know, pop music like Fleetwood Mac and stuff like that, synthwave kind of stuff, and you mix it with a little bit of that techno ravey feeling, and you mix it with a little bit of, you know, electro like Porter Robinson and those kind of artists of like 2010, 2011, you end up with this like weird middle ground in the gray area, which is what I consider Progresso. It's kind of like, it doesn't fit any of those genres necessarily, but there's small pieces of each.
Okay. you've mentioned Deadmau5 obviously multiple times, and you are currently signed with Mousetrap, his label. I know a lot of my listeners, and in particular, a few episodes back, I had Rip Kenny, who's this rock-infused dubstep producer, and cool. He was commenting that not enough podcasts kind of trace that transition from bedroom producer to, you know, being in the limelight. Can you kind of walk us through that transition?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is when you're quote unquote like a producer who made it, you don't really realize it. It's not something that's like you don't get to a certain point and you articulate that in your mind. That's like, this is now I've made it. I think that everyone who's quote unquote made it is kind of still in that bedroom producer mindset. You're still just as unconfident. You're still just as, you know, unsure of your music. I think that from a outside perspective, I guess if I had to look at it objectively, there's a few moments, like key moments that I think were pretty defining in that transition from the outside. Personally, I still view myself as a very like indie bedroom producer, but I guess objectively, you know, I do have some advantages in that, you know, I've been lucky enough to release on these bigger labels or like be affiliated with acts like Deadmau5. Some of those moments, there was this time, I think in 2016, where I was just a fan of Mousetrap at the time, and I was just posting all my music in the forums, you know, the Deadmau5 Facebook group and the Twitter and all that, Reddit or whatever. And somehow, I guess Joel got wind of my music, Joel being Deadmau5, for those who don't know. He got wind of my music somehow because I unbeknownst to me, I met Joel later that year, like I think it was like December or something along those lines of 2016 when he was doing his whatever tour that was, lots of show in a row or whatever. And when I met him and I had him signing, I think it was my laptop, just as like a meet and greet, I told him my name and he's like, oh, we probably have your name on some contract somewhere for some music. He was actually under the assumption that I had released with Mousetrap historically because I was so like prolific in the community of Mousetrap and Deadmau5. And I guess he heard some of my music, maybe some like unofficial remix or bootleg or something, and he assumed that it was a real remix or bootleg. So that was one of the more personal objective moments, I think, that really started that whole transition in career into like a full-time career, I guess. Another one about 6 months later, he was doing a live stream fest, or not a festival, sorry, but I'm just so like tainted with live stream festival. Whenever I hear live stream, I think festival now, COVID. Ugh. Anyway, he was doing a live stream for feedback, and you can send in music to have him, you know, listen to it on the stream, have everyone give their opinions in the comments. And I had sent in a song and he was like, oh, we got our local tryhard Julian Gray here, no stranger to Mousetrap, something along those lines. And for the second time, he assumed that I was on the label when I wasn't. And I think that was the more public occurrence. That was the time that it was really clear that, like, you know, maybe I should be on this label. And I met him a third time, and it was backstage at a festival. This is like the third occurrence. And that was the third time. That was the night of Countdown 2018, I believe. Maybe it was 2017. I can't recall. It's been a while now. But I met him a third time, and I was just so happened to be there because of, you know, my connections with all the fellow producers doing YouTube and all that sort of stuff. And I met him backstage and I met him personally. And when you're in person with somebody, I think there's more accountability there. So then, you know, then he was like, oh, I want to sign an EP based on that song you sent on the stream. And that the next day, you know, I signed Autonomous EP, which was it wasn't my debut officially on Mousetrap, but it was the first thing I signed. So like we signed the EP and then I signed a single called Resident Tryhard based on the quote that he said on the stream, in which I sampled and then released it on the label. So it was kind of a nice like jab back at Joel. It was kind of funny. But yeah, so those are some of the, I guess, the key moments that defined, I guess, the beginning of my relationship with them. But you have to understand, like, that's not really, in my mind, that's not where it started, because there was a lot of, you know, grinding and putting up music on the forums and being prolific in that community years before that, for them to even recognize, you know, me as a artist, that for him to confuse me for a mousetrap artist, you know.
Yeah. When you were grinding away and posting things in the forum, was that more, you knew that your sound, you wanted your sound to be something like Deadmau5's sound, and so you were seeking feedback? Or did you, were you from the beginning hoping to get signed with them? Was that a long-term plan of yours?
Yeah. So I was just, you know, 2010, a lot of people were becoming fans of electronic music. It was like the biggest bubble of all time. Like 2010, every song had dubstep elements. And that was like right when Deadmau5 was becoming popular and mainstream. And I, at the time, fell in love with Deadmau5. And from that point, it was a culmination of him and Daft Punk. I was really infatuated with electronic music. I wanted to start writing it. I already had that background in computers, like I said, and I was already interested in music, and I was, you know, playing some instruments at home and stuff. I was always pretty into that kind of stuff. But when I heard Deadmau5 for the first time, it was really like the start of when, like, oh yeah, I want to make that kind of music. I want to make electronic music that sounds like that. And then I just started writing music. I, you know, discovered Mousetrap, and like, if Deadmau5 exists, he has to have something sort of like home. And that was Mousetrap, and that's like Skrillex, and Zed started there as well, and Madion, and all those artists. And I was so inspired by the history of the label. I was like, okay, this is a goal of mine. I want to be on this label one day. And yeah, so I think a lot of those like early demos that I put out were less to like get signed, more to just be like, I wrote this, I really enjoy this, here, listen to it as well. You know, there's always this ever burning feeling in the back of my mind at the time of like, I eventually want to release on this label. But at the time, I think it was just like, I'm sharing music because I love this music and I want to share it with people. I just thought it was really cool. I thought the idea of writing an EP was cool. I thought the idea of like putting music out was awesome, and I would share it. And then some of the people in the Deadmau5 community or like the Mousetrap community would, you know, appreciate it. And then enjoy it themselves. So eventually I kind of garnered this, a little bit of a, you know, fan base on Facebook or whatever the platform was for the forums, probably like Reddit or what have you. And I guess that eventually caught the eye of Mousetrap and Deadmau5. And, you know, like I just described in that story, that's basically how it happened.
Obviously, we're looking at your success stories here. Was there ever a time where you submitted something for feedback and, you know, it was just really harsh feedback and you had to overcome sort of a lot of self-doubt? Or
yeah, I think that's something that every musician ever deals with, at least for the first, you know, 1,000 hours of writing, first 10,000 hours of writing before you're like good. There was definitely points where I'd put stuff out and people were just like, you know, slam it. There's even times where I was turned down by the Mousetrap A&R and what have you, like before that whole thing with Joel happened. I think, you know, you kind of try not to think about those kind of moments, I guess. Your mind kind of doesn't think about them. But there was a lot of times where, you know, I never thought that I would actually get there. I'd never release on Mousetrap. I'd never make a career out of electronic music. I guess throughout it all, I was lucky enough to have like the YouTube thing to sit back on, or fall back on, I guess the right term is. Because I've been doing YouTube since like 2011, and my YouTube fans at the time were pretty substantial. So I always had that to fall back on as far as like mental health goes, and be like, you know, I'm not like a total failure yet. You know, but yeah, I think everyone goes through that in a certain stage of their music. Even the more developed artists, like I get negative feedback now, even from big labels, you know. So I think it's something that you just have to learn to accept with a grain of salt and kind of just accept their feedback in the context of like who the person is. So like, if I ever get feedback, I try to gain a little bit more information about who is giving me feedback. Like, for example, like if my mother gave me feedback on an experimental like electronic music song, I know that she doesn't understand the demographic of this song, or like who I'm trying to write this for, or like the type of music I'm trying to write. So I don't weigh her opinion as much as someone like, you know, Mr. Bill, who has a very deep understanding of like forward thinking electronic music. So when you're collecting feedback, it's always best to kind of contextualize their feedback based on, you know, the type of person they are and their interests, and if they have an understanding of what it is that you're doing.
That's great advice.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about your YouTube channel, but I want to delve a little bit more into the, you know, your decision to sign with Mousetrap. I believe on one of the other interviews that you did, you talked about, you know, Mousetrap bringing a lot of resources. What has changed in terms of how you spend your time pre-Mousetrap versus post-Mousetrap? What are they bringing to the table, and what influenced you, other than the fact that, you know, it was a label you really respected? What influenced you to sign?
I think there's a misconception in 2020 that like when you sign to a label, especially in the electronic space, that you're kind of exclusive, like the old definition of signing to a label.
Okay.
For me, my agreements with any labels I work with, say Mousetrap and Deadmau5's team, or like Anjuna and Above and Beyond's team, or what have you, it's usually on a per song agreement. So you sign, like, let's say you sign a single, you sell them a single, they have the rights to the single, they promote the single, and then if it flops, then they're over it, or you're over it, and there's no like marriage there. There's longer deals that exist still. Like you can sign like a 5-album agreement, and then that's the agreement. But I think the idea of like, you know, signing your life away is kind of an outdated one, because people don't really do that anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's more of like you're signing a certain amount of music, whether it exists now or not. So like, I can say I signed my next 5 albums to blank record label. So that out of the way, I think one of the biggest benefits to working with a label like Mousetrap, or again, like Anjuna or Enhanced or any of the big ones I've worked with, is that they have a team of people and resources that, you know, you can get your music heard by people, Spotify, Apple Music, playlisting, whatever is relevant these days. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest, in my opinion, that's the biggest, draw of a record label, is to, you know, you're basically trading the ownership of your music for the chance that it's going to, you know, get more people to hear it, and also that you can, you know, make a little bit more money off of it than if you put it out yourself. So there's a big, like, you know, argument for both, like releasing on a label and not these days, because labels are getting less and less relevant as, you know, indie collectives and stuff. I actually own a collective called Gradient, start distributing music and finding success that way. A lot of the music industry now is based on like Spotify playlisting, Apple Music playlisting, you know, whether or not you can get a spot on any of those given playlists. And a lot of the times, if the label that you're working with doesn't have a quote unquote in there, it's actually not super valuable for you to release with them. But, you know, historically, I've found enough value with the labels I've worked with to garner selling my master recordings to them. You know, it's a trade-off, but you just have to kind of weigh the pros and cons of what your agreement says, because no record agreement is ever the same.
What factors would you recommend a young producer that's getting to that point where they're looking at, you know, should I release on a big label? What sorts of things should they consider and weigh in their pros and cons table?
Yeah. So this is something I've considered recently too. If let's say that you wrote this album that you really believe in, and you've gotten a lot of positive peer review, a label gives you an offer for it. Essentially, when a label signs your music, they're buying the rights to your music. in perpetuity, or at least for a extended period of time. And what you have to ask yourself is the value of this, like, I guess, initial bump of promotion, which, like, you know, record labels promote a song for maybe a month, and then, like, it's basically old news in 2020, you know? So, like, is this indie label that you're distributing your music with worth giving them the rights in perpetuity to the music? So, like, do you think that this music has a longevity enough that, you know, 5 years from now, the songs will still be popular and the label won't be doing anything for the songs? So if that's the case, then, like, basically they're just making money off of your popularity. But if it's a big label, like, let's say Warner, and it's a discography, like, let's say, like, Fleetwood Mac, again, as an example, people are still listening to those songs 50 years later, and Warner is still distributing and pushing those songs year after year forever. And that's a circumstance where it might be worth it to sell your songs to a label like that, because they're going to keep pushing that product forever. With indie labels or, like, smaller electronic labels, generally a promo push is only, like, a pop in the front. Like, you have, like, 2 weeks, maybe a month max of promo for the record, and then nobody ever hears from it again, unless it's, like, a huge record. So is it worth, I think the number one thing to consider is it worth trading that, those, like, lifetime worth of percentage of royalties on the song, for, you know, that initial bump of promo with smaller labels? Because 5 years from now, if the song is still kicking, there's a high probability that the label is not pushing that song in 5 years, and they're just basically making money off of the song. But then on the other hand, if the label is really helping and they're really promoting the song year after year, or, like, even, like, a huge bump up front that makes the song go from something that's, like, you know, nobody cares about this song that you just stick on SoundCloud, to, like, this is a international hit. Even if you can get that initial pump and the song becomes that big, you know, maybe then it's worth it, because now you're an international sensation, right? So it's that's something to consider when you're looking at a label agreement. You have to consider, is this promotional value that the label is providing worth the trade-off of me, you know, not owning 100% of the music or not making 100% of the royalties? So, and that's, like, the fundamental dynamic of a record contract.
Yeah. And that's so hard, because you never know what's really going to take off. I've heard lots of cases of musicians and bands that hated a particular song. They released it anyway, and all of a sudden that's the one that goes platinum, you know?
There's a really good example of that. I think MGMT, the band, they wrote an album of, like, parody pop songs that, like, they hate pop music, and they wrote an album of, like, songs that were supposed to be, like, a joke, and the entire album went, like, platinum. Or, like, a majority of the songs were, like, top 50 hits. And yeah, that's, like, a perfect example of that. Yeah. So you really never know when a song is going to do well. Sometimes you can get, like, an idea if you, like, play it for a handful of people and they're, like, really in love with it. But you really never know if it's worth it or not. But I will say that, like, a bad song, sometimes a good label can make into a hit. You hear it on the radio all the time. So it's, you know, if it's worth that promotional value for you, if it's worth the chance of growing in that regard, sometimes the label can be worth it. If you think that you have a huge hit on your hands and you're already a pretty established artist, and you don't think that they're going to be, you know, promoting it in 5 years, and the song's still going to be popular in 5 years, might not be worth it, you know? So that's just one of the main things to consider, I think, or at least what's been going through my head the past few years.
No, that's good. When you began releasing with Mousetrap, you know, that was a 4-year sort of almost courtship where you were posting regularly and interacting, and you had these face-to-face interactions with Joel. Were you also reaching out to other labels as well, or were you exclusively focused on Mousetrap at that time?
Yeah, there was a period of time, I think from, like, 2017 to 2018, 2018, early 2019, where I was doing almost exclusively Mousetrap releases. And that just comes from, you know, like my relationship with the team. And I saw how well the first EP did and stuff. And, you know, I was growing there. Because I have no exclusivity there, there's no reason for me not to shop elsewhere, though. So, like, if I see growth opportunity on a label like, let's say, Anjuna, which is equally big in a different, slightly off-axis scene of, like, trance, I often, you know, write a song and I send it to labels like that. So, like, if you look at my discography, there's actually a lot of different labels, especially over the past, like, 2 years. Just because I like to experiment and, you know, try out different things, you know, Mousetrap was like a big breakthrough for me because it was a, you know, a pretty sizable label that, you know, gets your foot in that door. But once you're in that door, it's pretty easy to convince other labels to release your music. It's no longer like a task to try to get people to be convinced that your music is like worth something. You know what I mean? So for me, I've been kind of testing the waters on a lot of different labels just to see, you know, how they work and what labels perform the best as far as that promotional thing goes, I was referring to earlier. And yeah, I've learned a lot of stuff and I've had a lot of cool releases with a lot of cool teams. 03, Enhanced Music, Colorize, and Juna are some of the notable ones. They're all awesome.
Here are some of my key takeaways from part one of the interview. First, don't stress too much if you haven't found your sound yet. It's a culmination of your influences and something most people stumble upon over time. Second, I was struck by Julian's humility. Every musician experiences doubts about their music and skills. That's normal. You just have to keep trying. Third, if you want to release music on a particular label, recognize that it can take time to develop that relationship. Julian was involved with the Mousetrap community for years and met Deadmau5 in person 3 times before he finally released on that label. So, identify the labels you're interested in and start building that relationship by participating in their online communities and attending events. Fourth, if you're getting feedback from people, take that feedback in context. Who are they and what's their perspective and bias? There's a big difference between getting track feedback from your mom and track feedback from an A&R rep from a major label. Fifth, don't get stuck in the mindset that signing with a label means you're exclusive. That's not the norm in electronic music. Generally, you sign for a song, EP, or perhaps an album, but then you're free to explore other labels. Finally, think carefully before signing. A label takes a good chunk of your royalties and may only promote your music for the first week or two. Ask yourself if the added exposure is worth the ongoing cost. Hey, if you enjoyed the podcast today, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating and review. And if you've got questions or comments, join the conversation at producerlifepodcast.com or on our private Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/producerlifepodcast. Also, make sure you smash that subscribe button wherever you're listening so you don't miss part 2 of this interview where Julian talks about what to consider when deciding to release a single or an EP, why he likes to include his own voice on his tracks, and how he built his wildly successful YouTube channel. Until next week, this is the House Ninja, reminding you to be somebody's hero today.